Chapter 2. The room into which he had been shown revealed a strange mixture of luxury and squalor. The windows were shuttered and curtainless, the floor was uncarpeted and strewn with packing cases, shavings, newspapers and boots, and the wallpaper showed the stains left by the pictures and furniture of the previous occupants. On the other hand, the only two armchairs were of the costliest type, and in the litter which covered the tables, cigars, oyster shells, and empty champagne bottles, jostled with tins of condensed milk, and open sardine tins with cheap crockery, broken bread, and teacups a quarter full of tea and cigarette ends. His host seemed to be a long time away, and Ransom fell to thinking of Devine. He felt for him that sort of distaste we feel for someone whom we have admired in boyhood for a very brief period, and then outgrown. Devine had learned, just half a term earlier than anyone else, that kind of humour which consists in a perpetual parody of the sentimental or idealistic clichés of one's elders. For a few weeks his references to the dear old place and to playing the game, to the white man's burden and a straight bat, had swept everyone, Ransom included, off their feet. But before he left Weddenshaw, Ransom had already begun to find Devine a bore, and at Cambridge he had avoided him, wondering from afar how anyone so flashy and, as it were, ready-made could be so successful. Then had come the mystery of Devine's election to the Leicester Fellowship, and the further mystery of his increasing wealth. He had long since abandoned Cambridge for London, and was presumably something in the city. One heard of him occasionally, and one's informant usually ended either by saying, "A damn clever chap, Devine," in his own way, or else by observing plaintively, "It's a mystery to me how that man has got where he is." As far as Ransom could gather from their brief conversation in the yard, his old schoolfellow had altered very little. He was interrupted by the opening of the door. Devine entered alone, carrying a bottle of whiskey on a tray with glasses and a siphon. "Weston is looking out something to eat," he said, as he placed the tray on the floor beside Ransom's chair and addressed himself to opening the bottle. Ransom, who was very thirsty indeed by now, observed that his host was one of those irritating people who forget to use their hands when they begin talking. Devine started to prise up the silver paper which covered the cork with the point of a corkscrew, and then stopped to ask, "How do you come to be in this benighted part of the country?" "I'm on a walking tour," said Ransom. "Slept at Stoke Underwood last night, and had hoped to end at Naderby tonight. They wouldn't put me up, so I was going on to Stirk." "God!" exclaimed Devine, his corkscrew still idle. "Do you do it for money, or is it sheer masochism?" "Pleasure, of course," said Ransom, keeping his eye immovably on the still unopened bottle. "Can the attraction of it be explained to the uninitiate?" asked Devine, remembering himself sufficiently to rip up a small portion of the silver paper. "I hardly know. To begin with, I like the actual walking." "God! You must have enjoyed the army, jogging along to Thingamy, eh?" "No, no, it's just the opposite of the army. The whole point about the army is that you are never alone for a moment, and can never choose where you're going, or even what part of the road you're walking on. On a walking tour you are absolutely detached. You stop where you like and go on when you like. As long as it lasts, you need consider no one, and consult no one but yourself. Until one night you find a wire waiting at your hotel saying, 'Come back at once,'" replied Devine, at last removing the silver paper. "Only if you were fool enough to leave a list of addresses and go to them. The worst that could happen to me would be that man on the wireless saying, 'Will Dr. Elwin Ransom believe to be walking somewhere in the Midlands?'" "I begin to see the idea," said Devine, pausing in the very act of drawing the cork. "It wouldn't do if you were in business. You are a lucky devil. But can even you just disappear like that? No wife, no young, no aged but honest parent or anything of that sort? Only a married sister in India. And then, you see, I'm a don, and a don in the middle of long vacation is almost a non-existent creature, as you ought to remember. College neither knows nor cares where he is, and certainly no one else does." The cork at last came out of the bottle with a heart-cheering noise. "Say when," said Devine, as Ransom held out his glass. "But I feel sure there's a catch somewhere. Do you really mean to say that no one knows where you are, or when you ought to get back, and no one can get hold of you?" Ransom was nodding in reply when Devine, who had picked up the siphon, suddenly swore. "I'm afraid this is empty," he said. "Do you mind having water? I'll have to get some from the scullery. How much do you like?" "Oh, fill it up, please," said Ransom. A few minutes later, Devine returned and handed Ransom his long-delayed drink. The latter remarked, as he put down the half-emptied tumbler with a sigh of satisfaction, that Divine's choice of residence was at least as odd as his own choice of a holiday.
"Oh, quite," said Divine. "But if you knew Weston, you'd realize that it's much less trouble to go where he wants than to argue the matter. What you call a strong colleague."
"Colleague?" asked Ransom inquiringly.
"In a sense."
Divine glanced at the door, drew his chair closer to Ransom's, and continued in a more confidential tone.
"He's the goods all right, though. Between ourselves, I'm putting a little money into some experiments he has on hand. It's all straight stuff, the march of progress and the good of humanity and all that, but it has an industrial side."
While Divine was speaking, something odd began to happen to Ransom. At first it merely seemed to him that Divine's words were no longer making sense. He appeared to be saying that he was industrial all down both sides, but could never get an experiment to fit him in London. Then he realized that Divine was not so much unintelligible as inaudible, which was not surprising, since he was now so far away, about a mile away, though perfectly clear, like something seen through the wrong end of a telescope. From that bright distance where he sat in his tiny chair, he was gazing at Ransom with a new expression on his face. The gaze became disconcerting. Ransom tried to move in his chair, but found that he had lost all power over his own body. He felt quite comfortable, but it was as if his legs and arms had been bandaged to the chair, and his head gripped in a vice, a beautifully padded but quite immovable vice. He did not feel afraid, though he knew that he ought to be afraid, and soon would be. Then, very gradually, the room faded from his sight. Ransom could never be sure whether what followed had any bearing on the events recorded in this book, or whether it was merely an irresponsible dream. It seemed to him that he and Weston and Divine were all standing in a little garden, surrounded by a wall. The garden was bright and sunlit, but over the top of the wall you could see nothing but darkness. They were trying to climb over the wall, and Weston asked them to give him a hoist up. Ransom kept on telling him not to go over the wall because it was so dark on the other side. But Weston insisted, and all three of them set about doing so. Ransom was the last. He got astride on the top of the wall, sitting on his coat because of the broken bottles. The other two had already dropped down on the outside into the darkness. But before he followed them, a door in the wall, which none of them had noticed, was opened from without, and the queerest people he had ever seen came into the garden, bringing Weston and Divine back with them. They left them in the garden and retired into the darkness themselves, locking the door behind them. Ransom found it impossible to get down from the wall. He remained sitting there, not frightened, but rather uncomfortable, because his right leg, which was on the outside, felt so dark, and his left leg felt so light.
"My leg will drop off if it gets much darker," he said.
Then he looked down into the darkness and asked, "Who are you?" And the queer people must still have been there, for they all replied, "Who? Who? Who?" just like owls. He began to realize that his leg was not so much dark as cold and stiff, because he had been resting the other on it for so long, and also that he was in an armchair in a lighted room. A conversation was going on near him, and had, he now realized, been going on for some time. His head was comparatively clear. He realized that he had been drugged or hypnotized or both, and he felt that some control over his own body was returning to him, though he was still very weak. He listened intently without trying to move.
"I'm getting a little tired of this, Weston," Divine was saying, "and especially as it's my money that is being risked. I tell you, he'll do quite as well as the boy, and in some ways better. Only he'll be coming round very soon now, and we must get him on board at once. We ought to have done it an hour ago."
"The boy was ideal," said Weston sulkily, "incapable of serving humanity, and only too likely to propagate idiocy. He was the sort of boy who in a civilized community would be automatically handed over to a state laboratory for experimental purposes."
"Well, I dare say. But in England he is the sort of boy in whom Scotland Yard might conceivably feel an interest. This busybody, on the other hand, will not be missed for months, and even then no one will know where he was when he disappeared. He came alone, he left no address, he has no family, and finally he has poked his nose into the whole affair of his own accord."
"Well, I confess I don't like it. He is, after all, human. The boy was really almost a preparation. Still, he's only an individual, and probably a quite useless one. We're risking our own lives, too, in a great cause. Oh, for the Lord's sake, don't start all that stuff now. We haven't time." "I dare say," replied Weston, "he would consent if he could be made to understand."
"Take his feet, and I'll take his head,"
said Devine.
"If you really think he's coming round," said Weston, "you'd better give him another dose. We can't start till we get the sunlight. It wouldn't be pleasant to have him struggling in there for 3 hours or so. It would be better if he didn't wake up till we were under way."
"True enough. Just keep an eye on him while I run upstairs and get another."
Devine left the room. Ransom saw through his half-closed eyes that Weston was standing over him. He had no means of foretelling how his own body would respond, if it responded at all, to a sudden attempt of movement, but he saw at once that he must take his chance. Almost before Devine had closed the door, he flung himself with all his force at Weston's feet. The scientist fell forward across the chair, and Ransom, flinging him off with an agonizing effort, rose and dashed out into the hall. He was very weak and fell as he entered it. But terror was behind him, and in a couple of seconds he had found the hall door and was working desperately to master the bolts. Darkness and his trembling hands were against him. Before he had drawn one bolt, booted feet were clattering over the carpetless floor behind him. He was gripped by the shoulders and the knees, kicking, writhing, dripping with sweat, and bellowing as loud as he could in the faint hope of rescue. He prolonged the struggle with a violence of which he would have believed himself incapable. For one glorious moment the door was open. The fresh night air was in his face. He saw the reassuring stars, and even his own pack lying in the porch. Then a heavy blow fell on his head. Consciousness faded, and the last thing of which he was aware was the grip of strong hands pulling him back into the dark passage, and the sound of a closing door.